welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Some kids dread bringing report cards home to their parents. I wonder if the state of Illinois feels the same way after this week. That's because new data was released as part of the State Board of Education's annual report card. And to learn more about the state of Illinois schools, we're joined in our Chicago studios by Advance Illinois' Deputy Director Ben Bohr. Madhu Krishnamurthy, who's also been covering recent news for the Daily Herald, is with us. Ben, Madhu, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being here with me.
Thank you
for having us.
So Advance Illinois, Ben, let's start with you. You all were founded in 2008 to be an independent voice in the state government system. I wonder what you thought of when you looked at, there's a lot of data here in the report, a lot of data about high schools that's maybe not so great. What was your first thought before we get into all the data just about when you saw the information?
Well, I mean, first of all, we think this report card is extremely important because it just provides the data that allows us to really get a broad view of the state's performance and then also look at individual schools and understand how each of them is performing. But, you know, one of the things we've continuously look at is the performance of low-income students versus non-low-income students. And, you know, once again, we have a very large gap. That's something we've highlighted in previous reports. And, you know, just as an example, in eighth grade, non-low-income students are hitting the proficiency bar at about 46%. That's either a three or a four or five on PARC, but low-income students are hitting that bar at about 18%, and so we have a huge gap there.
Yeah. So, and remind us, can you explain, PARC is a standardized test that's the commonly, that's sort of the acronym. There's lots of acronyms in education, right? And what we saw was that, Madhu, when we looked at the data, we saw, is it roughly two-thirds of students' grades third through eighth are not meeting expectations on the state standardized test?
They're not. It's about 34% of Illinois kids who are actually meeting the expectations. It's a slight improvement from the year before, but you have to also take into consideration that PARC is a new test. It's only been around for 3 years, and it's actually evolved quite a bit since its first year of implementation. So there's been some changes to the test itself, the timing, and they're still getting used to it. The kids have been testing both online and on paper in the first year, and then that switched to completely online testing in the second and third year. So there's some difference now with the test.
So there's difference in the way the test is administered. Is there also difference in the content of the test?
The content is constantly improved or changed, but what I'm hearing from some superintendents is that the test itself, there are different formats of the test that are given to students even in the same grade because they don't want cheating to happen, essentially. So there is so much variation that they feel that it's actually not even the same test within the same grade.
So we're going to talk about a couple standardized tests here. Let's just stay with the PARC for a minute. That's the Partnership for Assessment of Readiness for College and Careers. This standardized test is in standardized tests, Ben, are somewhat controversial, right, in education as a measure of success. I wonder if you can give a sense of what an Advance Illinois' perspective is on where how you see this as a measure of readiness in education.
So, yeah, I think, first of all, you asked about the content of the test. And it's, you know, as Madhu was saying, this is the first few iterations, administrations of the test. And the test was developed against a new set of standards. And so the new Illinois learning standards were developed a number of years and adopted a number of years ago. And so the bar really has risen for students. And so that's one of the things is we have to allow our schools the time to not only get used to the test, but also hit these new, start to understand these new benchmarks. And we think those benchmarks are real, right? The what's required of students going into college, going into career in the 21st century is just greater than it was before. And we all should be sort of pushing to get those, get students where they need to be. So that's really the critical thing there. I think people, when they talk about standardized tests, really in, you know, whether they measure, what exactly are they measuring, we think that this is a pretty good measure of whether students are prepared. But the flip is, how do you use that information? And, you know, how do you use that information? Really, the biggest thing is in terms of accountability. And I think many schools feel that the use of standardized tests, especially under previous federal law, under No Child Left Behind, was really unfair to schools. And we understand that. And, of course, there's now a new federal law, the Every Student Succeeds Act, that's replacing No Child Left Behind. There's a lot of work to be done there. But that's actually going to look far more at growth of students than it is at proficiency. So even the way we talk about our schools and the performance of our schools is going to have to change over the coming years.
Madhu, you surveyed, the Daily Herald surveyed about 540 suburban schools. And I think the data that, what did you all see in terms of how this test would have administered and what the results were for example, the schools you surveyed?
So we found that a majority of our elementary and middle schools that took the PARC test actually saw declines in their scores from the year before. And while some weren't remarkable, there were some that were like on the higher end, like 15%. However, there may be other factors that contribute to that. We heard that the state has changed the way that it reports scores this year. Previously, it used to be whatever home school the student belonged to, that's where their scores went to. But now, if you're served as a special education student, a gifted student, or maybe even a dual language student in another school, then your scores go toward the school where you're served. So that tends to skew some schools that house such programs like gifted and special education. So it's not entirely reliable if you see huge increases or declines, which you have seen in some schools.
Did you find anything surprising about the results?
We did find something interesting. The Daily Herald, for the past 3 years, we've been doing a poverty achievement index, which is pretty significant. We actually saw some schools with the higher percentage of low-income students were seeing gains, whereas schools with lower percentage of low-income students were actually seeing decreases.
So interesting. And Ben, that's kind of the opposite of what you were just talking about.
The gap is still there, but I mean, I think Madhu is correct. We are in some places, we may be seeing decreases in that gap. And, you know, that part of the reason that Illinois adopted new learning standards was that having those higher expectations for all students, the hope was that we would see that many of these students would start to increase their performance. I mean, we still have many other challenges to make that, to really close that gap, but it's interesting to see that.
Ben, you mentioned the Every Student Succeeds Act. That starts in August of 2018. What is that exactly, and what will it mean here in Illinois?
So it's the federal law that really provides for how education nationally is monitored and assessed. And it also includes, for example, Title I funding, which is our funding for low-income students. The Every Student Succeeds Act is actually the reauthorization of the bill from 1967, which is the Elementary and Secondary Education Act. So this has been the sort of law of the land in the United States for many years, and this is just the latest iteration of that. The difference, the really big difference this year is that as opposed to under No Child Left Behind, where there were really stringent federal guidelines about how we held our schools accountable, this gives the states a lot of flexibility about how they hold schools accountable. And so the state of Illinois has actually put forward its plan, and that's been approved by the U.S. Department of Education. And I will say, you know, there's a lot of differences, a lot of new measures, not just proficiency, but probably the biggest highlight is the emphasis on student growth and student progress over just hitting a proficiency bar. And we think that's a good move. The reality is that getting students proficient is really, really important, but schools can really control that growth. And we think it's really good that we're seeing that change.
We're talking education in state schools. That's Ben Bohr. He's Deputy Director of Advance Illinois. In studio with us as well is Radhu Krishnamurthy. She's a senior staff writer at the Daily Herald covering education. So we've been talking about the PARC standardized test. That's for grades 3 through 8. I want to talk about high school because another part of this results were SAT scores, Ben. I know this past year was the first year that high school juniors took the test for free at school. And what did we see, Ben?
So, I mean, we saw proficiency rates that were actually similar to our PARC rates. About one-third of the students, again, were at that proficiency bar.
So that means two-thirds of the students are not showing proficiency in the SAT. And the SAT, of course, Madhu, is our college entrance exam. So that's, when we think about standardized tests, obviously one that's a really important one.
It's at the end of the road, obviously, because these are kids in high school. What was interesting about the SAT, the way it's administered in Illinois, is Illinois set the bar even higher than the national standard for SATs. So you actually had to meet a composite score of 1080 to be considered college ready, according to Illinois. But the national standard is 1010. So a lot of kids did perform in that range, but they they fell short of the state standard.
So it seems like the important thing that we're talking about here is while the results on the face of it don't seem good or encouraging, sounds like both of you are saying that Illinois is setting some pretty high standards also that the state, both of you are now nodding, that we would like to see our students achieve. Ben, is that correct?
I think that's exactly right. I mean, what we're trying to aim for is what our students really need to achieve. And the things that we need to do to get there, that's a real conversation that the state needs to have, is we can't just be raising expectations without making the appropriate investments, training our teachers appropriately. There's so many things that need to occur, and the urgency is extreme, right? If Illinois is going to be a successful state, getting our students where they need to be is of the utmost importance, and yet so setting that bar high is a good thing. We just need to make sure we're really precise in how we measure schools. We don't blame our educators for not being at that bar yet, but in fact support them to get there.
Right. And in fact, you all, Advance Illinois, you work with the State Board of Education to help develop this report card, right?
So we Robin Staines, our former executive director, was on the committee that helped push this new report card forward. And the goal was to make it really usable and provide the data in a way that could be used by parents. We also put climate survey information on there so that parents don't just have that academic data, but they know what's going on in their school so they can make that data actionable.
During your reporting, Madhu, you had a chance to personally go one-on-one, speak to different educators about this. What's the general feeling that you've heard from your reporting on the report card results?
So as far as PARC is concerned, educators are in agreement that it is an important test to have, but they're not basing their results solely on this one test. There are multiple measures that are used within school districts, within the schools. They do their own internal assessments, like MAP assessments, and they rely on that more to guide them towards how they're going to change instruction and allocate resources. So they feel that that has bears more significance than the PARC because it's a snapshot of where students are rather than how they're growing and improving. The other thing is their ESSA, as we talked about, the new accountability system, really takes into account a more broader picture of how a school is doing. As Ben mentioned, there's the school climate survey. There's also emphasis on growth in the elementary middle schools as well as graduation rates at the high schools. And that's 50% of your score on ESSA, if you want to call it a score. But they're measuring schools quite differently starting next year, and it's going to be interesting to see, you know, what are our high-performing schools and which schools still need a lot of support. So the big difference between ESSA and No Child Left Behind is that it's not punitive. It actually helps the state target more resources and supports to the lower-performing schools.
One last question for both of you. The one thing we haven't talked about, which is always normally the focus of our conversations about schools and has been for the past 2 years during the budget impasse, is funding and funding levels. And we've had so many superintendents on this on the 21st talking about just the challenges that they've had to grapple with unprecedented over the past 2 years. Ben, I wonder from a funding perspective what Advance Illinois would like to see, how that relates to these results and how important it is just to have our public schools funded at an appropriate level, if you feel like we're at that yet.
No. I mean, so Advance Illinois was very involved in the new passage of the funding legislation that just went through this summer. And the reality is that's very much just a starting point. What we now have for every school in the state, every district in the state, is that we have the amount of money that we think we need to spend within that district. But many of our districts are really, really far away from that. And we think, in fact, that publishing the information about how adequately funded the districts are, along with information about their performance, is going to be pretty important. So, you might have a school that, given their adequacy number, how much we think we need to spend, they might be funded at 60%. And then if they have low performance, you have a conversation. That's certainly a conversation that both the community and the community needs to be having with the state as well.
All of that information is online. This report card, we'll tweet all of that out, and it'll be on our website as well, 21st Show, so everyone can go in and look up their individual schools. Madhu Krishnamurthy is a senior staff writer at the Daily Herald. We'll tweet out her article as well if you want to see the work she's done in the suburban Chicago area. I want to thank Ben Bohr, deputy director with Advance Illinois, for being with me. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Thanks for tuning in to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Today's sports headlines and columns are filled with opinions about what athletes should and shouldn't do when it comes to their political beliefs. Should they refuse to stand during the national anthem or refuse an invitation to the White House? It wasn't so long ago that Muhammad Ali forced Americans to ask a similar question. Should athletes fight in a war they don't believe in? Ali spoke out against the Vietnam War in 1967, telling a Chicago Daily News reporter, "I don't have no personal quarrel with those Viet Congs." It would become one of his most famous quotes, and after he officially filed paperwork to excuse himself from service as a conscientious objector, he went on to become one of the most famous anti-war figures at the time. Longtime Chicago-based journalist Jonathan Eig relays this complicated time and the entirety of the life of Muhammad Ali in his new book, aptly titled Ali, A Life. He's here with me in our Chicago studios. Hi, Jonathan. Welcome to The 21st.
Hi, Nyla.
So Ali was still alive when you started research for this book, and I think there are so many ways that you kind of view him. Depends on how old you are, and I think there are younger people who sort of know him vaguely as a legend but only saw him maybe in real life lighting the Olympic torch, and I think there are people who grew up adoring him and still think of him as the greatest athlete of all time, not to mention his incredible impact on culture and on the way he defined how Black men are seen. And then there's this whole larger-than-life persona in his personality, as much as any specific fact or event. The famous trash talker that we associate with float like a butterfly, sting like a bee.
Float like a butterfly, sting like a bee. Hey! Broke the old man's nose. Hey!
Somebody knows that I'm here with Sugar Ray. Joe wants a splat-footed, and somebody listen to splat-footed. Sugar Ray and I are two pretty dancers. We came to
As a journalist, how do you try to get to the truth of that?
To me, it was one of the greatest opportunities to tell a story that's just so quintessentially American and covers so much of American life. It covers race, religion, politics, and sports, obviously, you know, not to forget about the boxing. Ali was just such a huge figure, and I grew up in the 70s, and I can remember him as being more than a sports hero. He was like a superhero because he was funny and beautiful and outspoken and doing things other athletes didn't do. So trying to tell his life story was daunting, but it was also thrilling.
And as a journalist, how do you try to capture the truth between his larger-than-life persona and his personality and then the actual Ali?
Yeah, the trick is to get past the mythology, to get past the TV Hollywood version of the life and just to get into the real nitty-gritty. And I did that by interviewing everybody. I mean, I did more than 500 interviews for this book. I talked to almost everybody who knew him really well. I like to think. I'm sure that, you know, Ali was a very social person. There's a lot more people out there who I didn't get to. But all the key figures in his life really were on board for this book eventually, and I tried to talk to everybody.
And you spent years doing that.
Yes, I did. It was about 4 years of work.
Wow. So I wonder now when you think about, especially the past couple of months and all the headlines, when we think about Colin Kaepernick or Steph Curry and the positions they've taken that are public that many people are viewing as political, how much do you think about Ali and the political stances he took as an athlete?
I think he was the godfather of this movement in a way, because before Ali, Black athletes and Black people in general in this country were expected to be obedient and subservient and keep their mouths shut. And if you were lucky enough to get rich and famous as an athlete or an actor, you were expected to go along with the white man's rules and enjoy your success and don't put up a fuss. And Ali changed that. When he won the heavyweight championship, the very first thing he said is, "I don't have to do what you tell me to do anymore. I don't have to be what you want me to be. I'm free." And that Declaration of Independence was very upsetting to a lot of white people at the time. It was very thrilling to a lot of Black people at the time.
Where do you think that came from? I mean, as you did all of this research into his life and his personality and his ambitions, as you write about that he had in life, where do you think that ties into him also saying, like what you're saying, I'm free now, I can do whatever I want?
Well, you know, it's funny, Dick Gregory, the great comedian and activist who just passed away, said to me, "You need to understand, you need to try to tell me why a Black kid thought he could be special in the 1950s, because we were told that we were inferior. What made him think he could get away with calling himself the greatest of all time?" And that was the real challenge for me in this book, trying to understand him. And I think a lot of it had to do with his father. He was intimidated. He was beaten by his father, who drank heavily, and he wanted to prove he was better than his dad. He was also dyslexic and had a difficult time reading, but obviously knew he had this intelligence and was looking for a way to show that he wasn't just going to be limited by his inability to read. And then, you know, he discovered boxing, which broke all the rules of society. Boxing, a black kid can hit a white kid and get away with it. In boxing, when you stand in the center of the ring and they put a microphone in your face, you can say whatever you want and nobody can edit that. So a lot of things came together for Ali in just the right way.
But there was a fallout too, right? I wonder when we think about the fallout of what of his refusing to serve in the military and that sort of pivotal moment of his anti-Vietnam War stance, what was that?
He became the most hated man in America, certainly the most hated man in white America. He was seen as a traitor. He was seen as a loudmouth. He was seen as unsportsmanlike. And when he joined the Nation of Islam at the time was considered a terrorist group. The FBI considered them a threat to democracy. And here he was announcing that he was a part of this radical group that was even Martin Luther King said was out of line, that it was wasting its time because it refused to acknowledge that integration might be a solution. It thought there was no way that black people were ever going to be given a fair shot in this country, and the only way was to break away, and eventually all white people would be destroyed, and only black people would survive. That was the message of the Nation of Islam. So Ali became widely, widely hated.
I'm speaking with Jonathan Eig. He's the author of Ali, A Life. And there is a lot of Chicago in this, right? Because Chicago sort of holds a special place in his life. It's where he discovered the Nation of Islam. You write about during one visit, he discovered a recording of Louis Farrakhan singing A White Man's Heaven is a Black Man's Hell. Can you explain a little bit more about sort of his encounters with the interaction between Chicago and the Nation of Islam and the role that played in his life?
Sure. When Ali came to Chicago for amateur boxing tournaments, it showed him a world beyond the little world he'd known in Louisville, which was Jim Crow South. You come to Chicago and you see black people and white people interacting in ways that you would not see in Louisville. That was one thing. And it also gave him a sense of that he could be famous, that he could be big. He was fighting at the Chicago Stadium in front of thousands and thousands of people. Here was a sense that, you know, he could be something special. And then he also encountered here the Nation of Islam, which had its headquarters here under Elijah Muhammad. And he began exploring that. He took home a record from one of his visits of Farrakhan singing this song, "The White Man's Heaven is the Black Man's Hell." And he began to really embrace those ideas that white people were never going to accept black people, and that the world was made for white people, and unless black people did something radical, that was never going to change.
Before we came to America, we were living in the East. By the Nile River, we were living in luxury, enjoying freedom, justice, and equality. We wore silk and robes, slippers of gold. We were the wealthiest and the wisest people, I'm told. Now we are the poorest of the poor. Nobody wants us at their door. So, my friend, it's easy to tell. White man heaven is black man hell.
Why do you think this song had such an impact on him?
Well, in part, it was because he struggled with reading, I think. So he wasn't going to pick up the newspaper. He was drawn to the cartoons in the newspaper, Muhammad Speaks. But the song was a way for him to understand. He played that thing over and over until he had it memorized and drove his family crazy because he just never stopped playing that record. And I think that the song simplified it. He was very good at memorizing. So he would memorize lines from the songs, or he'd memorize lines from Elijah Muhammad's speeches and then repeat them as if they were his own.
So there's also a colorful story about his first trip to Chicago in the book. It was a trip maybe of many firsts. Is that how we would describe it?
Yeah, I think you're referring to his lost virginity, which he said occurred in Chicago, where he took a taxi down to the South Side and hired a hooker. Ali would have a very colorful sex life from that point on, and he described that scene in his own autobiography.
How old was he at that time?
I think he was 16.
Wow. Okay. And he was legally married 4 times. Some of those relationships overlapped. I think you describe how one of his wives even arranged hotel rooms for Ali and his girlfriend. And I wonder, all of your research on this and all of the women and the women that you talked to about him, what it made you think about his relationships with women?
Well, it made me think that he didn't really care too much about them. He was willing to use them in ways that were really discouraging for me as a fan of his to hear about. At the same time, these women continued to love him, and they put up with so much, and I was really puzzled to try to understand why that was the case. And even now, you know, talking to these women, you know, decades after their marriages had ended, they still light up when they talk about the man. And one of them said to me, "You just couldn't be in a bad mood when he was in the room. You know, you could be mad at him, and you could say there was no way you're ever going to forgive him, but he just had a way of lighting people up."
When we also think about his way of lighting people up, right, and I think that's sort of the way he was as an athlete, would you say that you found a lot of contradictions in his life between his public and private persona, between the way that he treated women, between also how that contradicts with the Nation of Islam? Because that came into conflict. You write about that.
Yeah, there were a lot of conflicts there. I mean, he loved Malcolm X and turned his back on Malcolm X and did nothing to try to prevent the assassination. He said that his faith exalted women. At the same time, he mistreated them terribly. He said that he was a pacifist, and yet he was a boxer. And there are so many contradictions in Ali's life. Even his opposition to the war was full of contradictions, because at first he said he didn't care if we killed the Vietnamese. He would be happy to use his tax dollars to support the war. And then later he said that he was a conscientious objector. So Ali was never easy to pin down, which made this book a lot of fun to work on.
A lot of fun. You did so much research. You were able to, the first time, get a hold of FBI records on Ali. What did you learn there?
A couple things. First of all, it was interesting that they never really viewed Ali as a threat. They viewed the Nation of Islam as a threat, and they were deeply concerned.
So why do you think they were keeping files? Was this just the FBI at the time?
I think it was because they were concerned about his effect on the draft. They were concerned that if
on
he
popular
was
popular culture,
right, that mm-hmm. that if he were allowed to get away with not fighting in Vietnam, then more and more people would embrace conscientious objector status, and in particular, African Americans might start signing up in large numbers for the Nation of Islam because it would give them protection. They were really concerned about that, and they wanted to keep an eye on him because they thought they might learn more about Malcolm X and Elijah Muhammad.
More did they?
Yeah, a little bit. But Ali never really hid the fact that he was hanging out with these
right.
guys. He was an open book for the most part. So I think the FBI had a pretty easy time keeping tabs on him.
When you say the FBI being worried about his public stance, his opposition to the Vietnam War, his conscientious objector status, I wonder, you know, how you see parallels today between athletes and the different athletes who are taking very public stances. I'm curious your thoughts on how, especially as I'm thinking about you in your past work chronicling so many other careers of great athletes in America, how you sort of, if you see a difference in the way they're treated if they are black men versus white men.
There's definitely a difference. I don't think we'd be hearing all of this about the NFL football players taking a knee if they were white athletes. If they were white athletes taking a stand against the war in Afghanistan or anything else, really, or just taking a stand against Donald Trump, we wouldn't be hearing that much. Nobody complains when, you know, Bruce Springsteen endorses Hillary Clinton, right? But black athletes are under much more scrutiny, and I think it's just blatant racism that we expect these guys to have no opinions. We want them to be entertainers. We want to watch them dunk the ball, and we want to watch them catch and throw, but we don't want to think of them as real people.
Or as people who have a political conscience or people who actually are pretty influential also.
Yeah, and the great thing is that these guys have their own platforms now, especially thanks to social media. I mean, Ali was lucky because he was a boxer and he could speak out from the ring after a fight and he wasn't really edited. But these guys, and for a long time we saw athletes really kind of keeping it quiet. They didn't want to offend their managers, their coaches, their owners.
They wanted to keep their jobs.
And they wanted to keep their jobs, and they wanted to keep their Nike endorsement contracts. But we're starting to see athletes today speak out more boldly, and I think that's a great thing.
Well, and I think when we think about athletes as role models, I wanted to ask you about Ali and the role that he played in your life as a kid. Do you remember sort of the first time you saw him, or what was it about him that captivated you?
Well, I certainly remember his fights on TV in the 70s, and I remember thinking that he was different from the other athletes that I idolized, because he was much, you know, Reggie Jackson was just a ball player on the field, and he had a personality, but he wasn't doing anything that you would get excited about or get angry about off the field. But Ali was this different kind of a person. He was an entertainer on the one hand. He was yucking it up. He was funny. He was also using his position to speak out on issues that were important to him. And it made me think, as a white kid growing up in the suburbs, what's he talking about? Who else is talking about this? What can I read to learn more about these things he's saying? And it definitely, sparked something in my curiosity.
Did you ever get to meet him?
I did, really briefly. You know, I spent 4 years or so on this book, and I interviewed almost everybody who knew him well, and I spent years trying to meet him and telling his wife, I really need to just talk to him and tell him I'm working on this book. And every time I went to try to meet him, he was too sick. I went to his house, spent 2 hours there, and he didn't come out of his room. But then finally, I did get to meet him about 6 months before he passed away, and he wasn't able to speak. He wasn't able to talk to me, but I at least held his hand and whispered and told him I was working on this book and thanked him for the opportunity.
The book is Ali, A Life. I've been speaking with author Jonathan Eich. He's actually going to be speaking, if you're in the Chicago area, as part of the Chicago Humanities Festival tomorrow at Northwestern Law School's Thorne Auditorium at 1 o'clock. We'll put up a link to tickets for that at our website. Jonathan, thanks so much for being with me here on
Thank
the 21st.
Thank you. This was fun.
The 21st is made possible by Kester & Bradley, LLP, providing legal services to the Urbana-Champaign community and Illinois residents since 1895. Kester & Bradley's attorneys are committed to achieving the best results for their clients. More information is available at KesterLawLLP.com.
You're listening to The 21st. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Nyla Boodoo.
Hello, everybody. This is Barack Obama, and we are here at the first Obama Foundation Summit in Chicago. We've brought together some amazing young people from across the country, from 60 nations around the world, people of different backgrounds, different professions, but all of them are asking themselves, how can they make a difference and bring about change in their communities, in their countries, in the world?
Of course, that's former President Barack Obama, who this week, as he said, brought together civic leaders, activists, former Obama staffers, and even a few celebrities. Besides the president and first lady, Lin-Manuel Miranda made an appearance, along with Prince Harry and Chance the Rapper. Attendees gathered to hear speeches and attend breakout sessions on tackling problems in different communities. It's in many ways a kickoff event for the Obama Foundation as well, as the stakeholders are hammering out plans for building the Obama Presidential Center in Jackson Park. Natalie Moore is WBEZ's Southside Bureau reporter. She was at the summit all week. She's on the line with us from there now. Hey, Natalie, welcome back to the 21st.
Hey, Nyla.
So what was the mood like at this foundation summit for the week? Is there a way you could describe it? It seems like there's been a lot of excitement in the city all week about it.
I would say there was definitely a lot of excitement in the hallways. The media wasn't allowed to go into any of the breakout sessions. We were able to go to the main events in the ballroom. But, yeah, Obama and Michelle Obama still have a lot of star power. They're still inspiring people. And there were 500 participants in the summit, and they came from 60 countries in every state. And the topics were arranged from rural issues to opiate use to fiction writing to how Google is a threat to democracy, social media can be a threat to democracy. So tech, labor, business, arts, mass incarceration, race.
Wow.
People from Brazil, people from Nigeria. Yeah, it was, and those are the things that I was able to hear. So it was pretty packed. And this is the biggest event that the Obama Foundation has put on since its formation. And the former president has said several times that he wants his legacy to be about training the next generation of young people. That's what he wants the centerpiece of the Obama Foundation to be.
And so was that, did you get a sense that that was, you named so many different topics there, Natalie, but did you get a sense that was sort of the common thread throughout all of this, was trying to train a next generation of leaders on a whole host of all of these topics you just talked about?
You know, he likened this to a big brainstorming session. There wasn't any sort of outcome of, okay, we're going to solve this problem, or these are the top five issues that we're going to take. It was more about how you engage in your community. And I think it was also about networking. When at the closing remarks, you know, before the big concert with Chance the Rapper and Gloria Estevan, participants had a card in their seat. And Obama told them to fill it out, and it said, you know, when I leave here, I plan to do X, Y, Z. And he said, don't write anything like, you know, solve injustice, but put some sort of small goal on there. You know, maybe it's talking to someone who shares different views than you on an issue. But he also said that he was trying to create a community and for these people to stay in touch and to network with each other. And one of the participants that I followed, actually, you interviewed him many years ago. He told me you were his very first interview.
I interviewed him a few. I recognize the name.
YO.
Yeah, okay. And, oh, when he was in high school.
Probably, because he's 23 years old.
Yes, I totally remember that interview. Mm-hmm. Yes.
So he's a community organizer in the Chicago Southside Back of the Yards neighborhood. And he's a really dynamic young man. And so I did a story that looked at the summit through his eyes. What did he learn? What did he get out of this? And he said the best part were the hallway conversations, the networking, the exchanging of information, people who were doing similar work or people who were interested in his work. And that's what he got out of it.
And so I remember Alberto. That's funny, Natalie, because I remember after I interviewed him thinking, and I think I told him, I said, I feel like you're going to end up being a community organizer. And he was like, I am.
Well, but that is exactly what he's doing.
How did folks like Alberto end up there? You said there were 500 people who ended up there. How were they picked and how many applied?
Most of them applied. 20,000 applied. Berto told me
20,000 people applied to attend this?
He said that he did not apply. Someone nominated him. And I did get the foundation to send me the form. It had questions like, what are you doing to better your community? What do you hope to get out of this? It wasn't an extensive application.
And so for listeners who might not be familiar, Natalie, can you remind us about the Obama Foundation and the goals that they have? Because this was kind of really the first actual tangible event of it, right?
It was the first large-scale event. This fall, the Obama Foundation started laying out their public programming. They're going to be traveling to other cities. The summit in Chicago was their biggest event. It was a global summit. But they also have done a smaller event in Chicago, and they put out applications for people to be an Obama Fellow. It doesn't mean you would have to move to Chicago, but again, the criteria here is that you are doing some type of civic work or trying to better your community.
Natalie, Michelle Obama gave a speech during the summit, and one of the things she mentioned was the need for public art, especially on Chicago's South Side. Let's hear a little bit of that.
Think about how little art there is, public art there is in communities on the South Side, which is, you know, one of the things we hope to do with the Obama Presidential Center. There need to be places for public art outside, just like downtown, just like the Picasso, just like the Bean.
That's Michelle Obama at the Obama Foundation Leadership Summit in Chicago this week. We're talking to WBEZ Chicago's Natalie Moore about it. She was there all week. Natalie, how much of Michelle Obama's speech and the summit in general was about Chicago in particular, or Illinois? You said it was a global summit. There were people there from all over.
I would say not a lot. You know, this was never billed as a Chicago-centric event. This was the only time in the ballroom, in the public plenary, well, not public, but the main stage plenaries, in which the Obama Presidential Center was talked about. The tape that you played from Mrs. Obama was when she was in conversation with her friend, poet Elizabeth Alexander. They talked a lot about art. Michelle Obama is from the South Shore neighborhood, which is near Jackson Park, where the Presidential Center is going. And she's made a point to say that she wants to put things there that she didn't have growing up, such as sledding. And we just heard her mention public art. So this is a, you know, she was very much an arts advocate when she was in the White House, and she says she plans to bring that to the Obama Center.
Natalie, I want to get back to the Obama Center in Jackson Park in the neighborhood in a minute, but I just want to stay on the former First Lady speech. I saw a tweet you had where she said, we have to think about, she talked a lot, I don't know if she talked a lot about work-life balance, but she said we're raising adults, not children. Did she spend a lot of time talking about that?
She did. She said that she didn't grow up in a household where it was children are seen and not heard. Now, that did not mean that you got to disrespect your parents or that you got to talk back to a teacher, but it meant that her parents asked her and her brother their opinions on family matters. They knew about household budget. Things weren't kept a secret because, you know, you're a child. They were age appropriate, but she said as a five-year-old, she was asked her opinion, and, you know, she really carried that with her.
She also talked about happiness. I wanted to play that.
You got to work at some happiness, too. You got to think about, in this year, when am I going to laugh? When am I going to have fun? When am I going to stop and smell the roses? And then you got to plan it.
I wonder, Natalie, when I was thinking about, when I was reading different parts of the, or hearing about the speech, it sounded like, I don't want to say very Oprah-esque, but it sounds like she went a lot of different places and shared a lot more about herself.
She did. She talked about the importance of having girlfriends, and that kept her sanity when she had to live in, you know, a tight, secure bubble in the White House. She talked about her schedule and trying to put, you know, her children, her husband first, and not, you know, maybe a speaking engagement. And I took that these are lessons that she learned, not just being in the White House, but, you know, she was a successful career mom before she moved to Washington, D.C. You know, she talked about her modest upbringing, some things that we have heard before, but hearing her talk about child rearing, how she sees that balance, that was definitely more insightful.
And a new side of her. As you mentioned, she grew up not too far from where the Obama Center is planned to be built. I wanted to just ask you about that. This summer, we talked to Jawanza Malone with the Kenwood Oakland Community Organization. And he and a couple other community activists on the South Side were worried about the development around the Obama Center. They've been talking for months about having a community benefit agreement between the neighborhood and the Obama Center. I wonder if that issue came up at all, if you heard that from any of local people who were attending and where we're at with that?
It did not. I don't think any of those CBA advocates were invited, or they certainly didn't seem to be at the summit. President Obama himself has said that he is not for a CBA, and there are people who question, you know, you were a community organizer. You're training this next generation of community organizers. This is something that you would have been fighting for. It's something that people going back in their communities could be fighting for. So there's some irony that people do see in that.
I guess last question for you, what do we see? I mean, do we expect more events like this going forward that will be taking place in Chicago on the South Side?
I don't think so on this scale. I think this took a lot to pull off in a few months. This was the inaugural one. I think it's a good possibility we would see something of this scale once a year. But the Obama Foundation is still trying to figure out how it wants to realize its goals.
And I guess this is different than, say, like the Clinton Global Initiative, right? I wonder if this was akin to an event like that, what we saw with the Clinton Foundation, sort of with the things that the Global Initiative, did it have a similar feel to that with community organizing? And again, I guess, as you said, all of this is sort of being worked out and thought out.
You know, I would say no, but it's still very new. it seems like the Clinton Foundation takes on issues that are global, and it seems like the Obama Foundation is more focused on the people going back to the communities. And this Presidential Center, if it goes as planned, there isn't any kind of, I mean, it's not called a presidential library because it's not even going to be the traditional library. This is something that will be certainly unique.
WBEZ Chicago's Natalie Moore is their Southside Bureau reporter. Natalie, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Before we leave you for today, this weekend is the perfect time to hit the road and check out the changing fall leaves all over the state. We actually talked about that earlier this week with Nuno Ribeiro from the University of Illinois about the best places to go. After the segment, a few of our listeners reached out to us on Facebook and shared some of their favorite fall destinations. Sarah from Freeport says that if you're traveling from Rockford to Galena, Freeport can't be missed. It's home to Little Cubs Field as well as the Lincoln Douglas debate site. Tim from Oregon, Illinois, says the Rock River Valley has a lot to offer. Oregon is just 30 minutes south of Rockford, and Tim says they're developing, quote, treehouse lodging, historic riverside cabins, and bison tours. If you'd like to read Nuno's list of recommendations or tell us your favorite fall spots, check out our website, 21stshow.org. You can always connect with us anytime on Facebook, like Sarah and Tim did, by searching for the 21st, or on Twitter at 21stshow. We'd love to hear from you. That's it for us today. We're produced by Robin Lynn, Alan Montesilio, and Bob Holly. Libby Foster and Grace Stetson are our interns. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft, Jerry Moorfield, and Steve Mork. Scott Cameron is our executive editor. Thanks to the University of Illinois' Social Media Analytics Lab for their research help, and special thanks to the band Public Access for our theme music. I'm Nyla Boodoo. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media, broadcasting today from the Medill Graduate School of Journalism in downtown Chicago. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend.